court would like to welcome this morning schools from Parker, Alcester, Flandreau, Dakota Valley, Rutland, Lincoln High School, Mitchell Christian, Mount Vernon, Woonsocket, Garrettson, Chester, Baltic, Augustana, Sioux Falls Christian, and the North and South Dakota Judicial Training Seminar. The first case for oral argument this morning is in the matter of the dissolution of Midnight Star Enterprises. For the appellant, Midnight Star Enterprises, is Mr. Michael Reynolds, an attorney from Rapid City, and for the appellees, is that cannabis? How do you pronounce it? Okay. Are Mr. Richard Plummer and Mr. Dylan Wild, attorneys from Spearfish. Will be Mr. Plummer and Mr. Wild arguing this morning. Okay, very well, Mr. Plummer. Mr. Reynolds, then you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. I submit that there's one principal issue to be considered here, which inspires one principal question. And the principal issue is the appropriate standard, methodology, and application of the term fair market value as that legal term of art is utilized in the state of South Dakota, not just in dissolution actions, but in any action where business valuation is important.
Mr. Reynolds, perhaps for the benefit of the audience, you could give us a brief recitation of the facts.
Sure. That'd be fine, Your Honor. Essentially, at an April 27th hearing relating to a dissolution proceeding that Mr. Costner brought, Mr. Costner is a 93.5% owner of the Midnight Star Enterprises Limited Partnership through himself and his wholly owned company. He brought a dissolution action to disassociate himself from the 6.5% partners, Mr. Knieva and Mrs. Knieva, each who owned 3.25%. At a hearing before the court on April 27th at our urging to determine the fair market value of that business, the court opted to, instead of accepting the fair market valuation as touted in IRS Revenue Ruling 5960, decided to opt with a person from the street who essentially said he would pay $6.2 million for the Midnight Star Enterprises, even though he hadn't reviewed a financial statement and hadn't undertaken any efforts to try to determine what the course of the business was.
So it would be a fair statement that what we have here is two partners that are going to go their separate ways, and what you're arguing this morning is what the business is worth, correct?
In essence, Your Honor, but what I'm arguing more precisely is what the appropriate methodology is for fair market value determination, and that's where, respectfully, the court made its principal error, because instead of relying upon a hypothetical willing buyer and a hypothetical willing seller, which is absolutely imperative for a fair market value analysis under the law, it took this offer, with quotes around the term offer, of a third party as gospel truth and accepted that as the value of the business, and that is not what a fair market value analysis is. In fact, there's not a court in American jurisprudence or a case in American jurisprudence that has accepted that as a fair market value assessment. And let's look at the law for a moment, if we could. The Bible for this is IRS Revenue Ruling 5960. That is, as this court has said, the most substantial body of official guidance for valuing an interest in a closely held corp. And, of course, the same would apply to a partnership, which has the principal qualities of a closely held corporation. So this court has already said this is essentially the Bible of business valuation. In 5960, it says specifically, and this is its language, that there must be a hypothetical willing buyer and a hypothetical willing seller. Every case, every treatise says that. But that isn't what the court followed in this case. The court took this offer from Mr. Keller, who never looked at a financial document, took the number from our appraisal expert, who is probably more qualified than anyone else in the region, and just said, I'll pay double it.
Counsel, there's nothing in the code that requires the court to do what you wanted it to do. Isn't there some discretion here that the court has as far as methodology?
There's always equitable powers within the court, but I would submit there isn't a case that allows the court the scope of equitable authority that it exercised in this case. If the court were to accept the fair market value analysis of Judge Johnson in this case, it would be essentially a rogue court in that there's been no other court in a tax court, a federal court, or a state court that is found to the contrary of what I'm arguing here today with regard to fair market value.
Do you contest that the offer was a valid one at $6.2 million?
I don't know whether it was or not. My personal belief is that it was an effort at grandstanding. Did the gentleman have the apparent wherewithal to make a $6.2 million offer? I would say the answer is yes. What his personal motivations were, none of us can crawl into his head.
But he had $6 million on the table. He was ready to pay for this business.
That's right. But that is not fair market value.
And Judge Johnson found that it was a bona fide offer.
He did find it was a bona fide offer. But I'd submit that's not relevant to an assessment of what a fair market value analysis is. And let me use an analogy. Let's assume that 50 experts had found that the operations and assets of the Washington Pavilion were worth $50 million. Bill Gates walks in here, looks around, doesn't look at a financial document, doesn't care what the expert says, and offers $200 million. Now, does he have the wherewithal to do that? Sure. Is it a bona fide offer? Presumably. Is that a fair market value assessment? Absolutely not, because it is not what the market, income, or asset value of this business is. And fair market value analysis is not the highest or the lowest number. It's the most probable and reasonable number. What you're trying to find is what's best for the parties here. And that's why IRS Revenue Ruling 5960 and all the treatises say you have to look at a hypothetical transaction to take the personal motivations, to take the irrationalities out of it. You can have an irrational buyer who will overpay for something. You can have an irrational seller who won't accept an offer that's 50 times what the value of the business is, because we have the right to do that as human beings in America.
But isn't fair market value the business arrangement between a willing buyer and a willing seller, both capable of taking care of their part of the deal? Isn't that what we have here?
No. It's a hypothetical willing buyer and willing seller employing the factors of 5960, which includes common sense, this is out of 5960, reasonableness, which is 5960, and informed judgment, which is 5960. And 5960 says quite specifically, you have to look at things like the nature of the business from the inception, the economic outlook of the business, the book value of the stock, the earning capacity, the dividend paying capacity, the goodwill, the stock sale history, the market price. That's straight out of the language of 5960. You must look at those factors. Mr. Keller did not do that, and the court did not adopt that as a methodology. Mr. Thorsenson did.
What other evidence did the court have before it as to value?
The evidence the court had before it, Your Honor, was Mr. Thorsenson's report, number one, his testimony, number two, and Mr. Keller's testimony, number three. Those were the three items.
So you say that all the jurisdictions in the nation have gone with your evaluation or the hypothetical rule rather than a fair market value that goes to the best offer. What is the reason behind the rule that all these cases have done this?
Because the concept of fair market value is not what is the highest or the lowest. The concept is what is the reasonable and most probable. And because of the fact that human beings do irrational things, they offer more than they should for things, or they don't accept purchase prices that they should, to find a fair market value, you take the personal equation out of it. And that's why the courts have followed it. I mean, if you look at the treatises that I cite in my appellate brief, Mercer, for example, talks about the fact we're taking out the human equation, we're taking out personal motivations, and we're looking simply at what a reasonable, rational, informed person would pay or sell a business for.
But there's got to be a reason behind the rule. There's got to be a reason to support the rule. Yeah, I mean, is it so that the people involved in the business entity, the partnership or limited partnership, can buy their own business back? Or, I mean, what is the reason for it?
Well, I think it depends on what the application of why you're looking for the fair market value is. In this instant case, fair market value is set forth within the limited partnership agreement, and it says you have to do that analysis. But it could change from entity to entity. I mean, there could be many reasons why an entity wants to do a fair market value analysis. It could be something a court dictates under its equitable powers. It can be an agreement. In this case, it's an agreement. Under 10.3.1 of this agreement, it says you determine fair market value for these purposes. So then once you have an agreement that says that, in this instance, you look at what the law says. And the law says you follow 5960 by the letter. It doesn't say you go out and you send the litigants out to determine who can find the best straw man or actual bona fide offerer to find the highest number or the lowest number. It says you do a quantifiable scientific analysis of the books and records and you come up with what is the most reasonable and probable price. And it's an issue of fairness. The reason it's called fair market value is for a reason. That word fair is not just in there at someone's whim and fancy. It's to find what is fairest to all litigants in this situation. And in order to do that, you don't look at what one litigant was able to go out and do to find this person that will offer twice the value of a business. You find what scientifically or artistically, depending on how you view accounting, what an analysis of the books and records will mete out. And that's what did not happen in this situation. The court did not follow that standard. The court simply said, and the language is cited in my appellate brief, it said, well, I've got Mr. Thorsen's analysis and methodology. I reject it. How can I tell one partner that the business is worth 3.1 when I got someone willing to pay 6.2? And that sounds great on a surface level, but it ignores 5960 and it ignores the analysis the court was to do, which was not to find the highest number, but was to find the fair market value.
What's the significance of the fact that 5960 was addressed in the context of an estate and gift tax case? Has that been applied other places? I mean, you might argue that this isn't a estate or gift tax case.
Sure. It applies, Your Honor, in the cases that I cite in my appellate brief, in all contexts and all efforts of valuing a business. And that's what 5960 talks about, is how do you value a business? It doesn't limit it to estate and gift tax. This court hasn't limited its analysis of 5960 to estate and gift tax. It's an issue of business valuation. How do you value the fair market value of a business, whether a closely held corporation or a partnership or a limited partnership or an LLC? It's a legal term of art. And that's been around almost now for 40 years that we've applied 5960. It is the Bible. As Mr. Thorsensen said, there has never been a situation, it's unprecedented, for a court to accept somebody's rogue offer as fair market value of a business. That's not fair market value.
Counsel, you, your client petitioned for dissolution of the partnership. And I'd like to know, there's two provisions in the contract with respect to liquidation. One has to do with distribution in kind, and the other one has to do with simple liquidation of the assets. Which are you asking for, 10.3.1 or 10.4?
10.3.1. And that's a very important distinction. I'm glad you brought it up, Your Honor, because Mr. Plummer will undoubtedly argue that 10.4 applies in this case. It's very important for this court to understand you cannot read 10.4 the way Mr. Plummer reads it and have 10.3.1 have any meaning. Mr. Plummer will argue, and has argued, that 10.4 forces the partnership in the event they ever want to split up. It's got to be sold to the open market.
That's a distribution in kind. If everybody wants a distribution in kind, then you have to offer it to third parties first.
Right.
But if your client is willing to pay cash for value, pay for his share of the assets, then, as I understand it, then there's an appraisal, and then...
And he is willing to do that, Your Honor, and you've hit the nail on the head. Mr. Plummer's interpretation is different. Mr. Plummer's interpretation is to ignore the language distribution in kind and to say it's got to be sold to a third party. It's got to be sold on the street. That's what he said in all his pleadings that he submitted so far. You're right. It doesn't. We don't have to do that. And we are more than willing to pay our partners their value of what their interest is, and they have indicated that they'd be willing to do that. The fight here is what the interest is valued at.
But as I understand it, if your valuation prevails, you pay nothing to the minority partners because of the capital accounts and the other order of distribution of assets.
That'd be correct. The order of priority is payment of debt, reserves if any, payment of capital accounts, and anything left is paid out to the partnership on a pro rata basis. In this situation, Mr. Costner has a capital account of $4.9 million, I believe is the number. The Knievis capital account is zero. So it's true that any value less than $4.9 million of this business would go 100% to Mr. Costner.
So they get nothing.
They
if your value is used, and they get something if the offer is used.
They get a little bit if the offer is used, but that's, you know, respectfully irrelevant. The issue is what the fair market value is. If that number were zero, if the capital accounts were zero, it shouldn't change the underlying analysis of the court. Fair market value is what fair market value is.
So if we accept your argument then that the way the court made the valuation is improper, then as I understand it, then you would ask that the case be sent back to the court, and that would give the Knievis an opportunity to bring in an expert to counter your expert and give testimony about what the Knievis feel the value is.
We would welcome that. We asked for that for 2 years for them to tout an expert of that nature rather than the methodology that was adopted. We certainly, for the purposes of being fair and honest, will argue that the door may be closed to them because they had 2 years to do that and didn't. But yes, it's very important for this court to understand what we're asking for is the court to apply a fair market valuation standard under the law. That doesn't mean they have to accept Mr. Thorsensen's analysis. And it doesn't mean that they have to accept presuming the Knievas come up with somebody, their analysis. The court can make a determination. It just has to follow 5960. It can order a third party to come in, some independent person to come in and make this valuation analysis, as long as it's done under the guise and the applicability of the reasonableness factors of 5960. And I think Mr. Plummer points out in his brief that he essentially denigrates Mr. Thorstensen's analysis. That's irrelevant as well. This isn't an issue whether Mr. Thorstensen's analysis is correct, which I submit it was. It's an issue whether the court misapplied the law, and it did. So, yes, I would be asking for a reversal and remand, a determination under the law of 5960 of fair market value, exercising the reasonableness tests. The court can make an ultimate determination evaluating those expert reports or whatever other evidence it wants to evaluate to support common sense, informed judgment, reasonableness, and the 8 or 10 factors that I set forth, such as looking at income statements and cash flow analysis and things that have to be done for a 5960 analysis, then it can make a fair market value determination. Go from there.
If it were reversed and remanded for that purpose, wouldn't that be given the other side a second bite of the apple? They've had an opportunity to present evidence of fair market value. Instead, they presented evidence of the best offer. And so wouldn't that be giving them a second bite of the apple?
It would indeed, and that's why I made the point that we would certainly argue they've had that opportunity and waived it. But it would be within the court's discretion to say, in light of what's gone on, I made an error, and I'm going to allow the Knievas to come in and bring in an evaluation expert, and you can have a battle of the experts.
Okay, and you concede that that would be a matter of discretion on the circuit court judge's part?
I would. I would argue vociferously that he shouldn't, but he has that right, and my guess is he probably would exercise that discretion because he wants to do the right thing. This is a good judge we have here. I presume that would happen in the chain of events, as he would allow the Knievas the opportunity to retain an expert to do a fair market value analysis. With regard to, I think Judge Justice Konenkamp hit the nail on the head on the forced sale issue. You know, there's several reasons why a forced sale is absolutely contrary to not only the limited partnership agreement, but the law in and of itself. First of all, the distribution in kind point is critical and one that's been glossed over by the trial court and by Mr. Plummer. There is no requirement that because the partners want to separate, it has to be sold on the street. That's an economic waste, as the case law indicates. And it's also not what the hearing was about. The limited partnership agreement says there are several methodologies that can be adopted here. One, it can't be sold to an insider until there's a fair market value analysis. That's why we were in front of the court. That's why we were asking for the fair market value analysis. After that happens and the fair market value is assessed, then the partnership can act in a variety of different ways. But that's not a forced sale. 10.4 is an option that can be exercised by the general partner. It says, other than 10.3, the general partner may distribute in kind. It has not exercised that offer or that option at this point in time. And in fact, that is essentially an opt-out provision of 10.3.3, which is the provision that sets out the priority of debts, reserves, paying back capital, paying back to partners. 10.4 says after debts are paid, the general partner may distribute in kind as long as it's tried to make a sale to a third party. That hasn't happened here. The only way to reasonably interpret 10.4 and 10.3 so it doesn't read 10.3 out of this agreement is by virtue of the interpretation that we've set forth today. I'd also submit that with regard to equitable powers, it would be incredibly draconian to force a partner that owns 93.5% of this business, that put all the capital into the business, that wants to have a presence in Deadwood, South Dakota because it's meaningful to him, not because he's making any money, but because it's meaningful to him, to have to sell out his business when there's no requirement under the limited partnership agreement for that to happen. This court has had precedent in the past. You may remember the Pesca case, a gentleman here from Sioux Falls who built a cabin in contravention of covenants, and the trial court had said, you got to tear it down or move it. And this court said, that's draconian. That's in violation of property interests. I'd also submit that the court didn't even...
You have 2 minutes, counsel.
Thank you. I'd also submit that the court didn't even follow 10.4 when it forced the sale. It was kind of, with all due respect to the court, a strange amalgam of different component parts of the limited partnership agreement in his own decision. If he would have adopted 10.4, he wouldn't have had to ask for a fair market value analysis because under Mr. Plummer's interpretation of 10.4, he just sell it on the street. There's no need for a fair market value analysis. So he didn't employ 10.4. And he didn't employ 10.3 because 10.3 says you do a fair market value analysis, which he did not do, and then it could be sold to insiders, which he didn't allow. So he didn't follow 10.3. And then in addition to that, he allowed the general partner 10 days to accept the fair market value and buy it. That's not in 10.3, 10.3.1, or 10.4. So respectfully, the judge didn't follow the limited partnership agreement in any way, shape, or form in applying this forced sale. And I respect what he was trying to do. He was trying to bring the issue to a head. He said, you know, let's get this done in 10 days or we'll see where we're going. And that's sometimes an important and valuable thing for a court to do. But it was in violation of the limited partnership agreement and is not set forth in either Mr. Plummer's 10.4 or the 10.3.1 or 10.3 as a whole.
Do the majority owners get the right to vote, get the right to purchase first, or does the minority owners also get to buy it at 3.1 if that's the fair market value?
Under 10.3.1, after the fair market value, there's a vote. Now, we know what's going to happen. The vote will be that the general partner will buy out the limited partner, the two minority partners. But we can't lose sight of the fact that majority rule still applies in the state of South Dakota. It's a 93.5% ownership. All the money was implemented by Mr. Costner. The agreement was evaluated by sophisticated counsel.
Your time has expired, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Plummer, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court. Thank you, Chief Justice and counsel. With me is my new associate, Dylan Wild. Some of you may remember him. Mr. and Mrs. Kaneva, my clients, are also in the audience today, and I welcome them to this argument, and I trust that I'll do them justice. Mr. Reynolds and I have tried two different cases on two different tracks throughout the entire period of time that this case has been before the trial court. Mr. Reynolds studiously avoids quoting to you the language of the partnership agreement. We gloss over it and suggest that it's merely a matter of assigning a fair market value to this business, allowing Mr. Costner to buy it out at a price, but only at a price, that generates my clients nothing. That is not what the partnership agreement provides.
However, if we were to remand it, and it's possible that the trial court could determine that the fair market value is the value that of your witness that testified.
I think the trial court has already made that determination, with all due respect.
But if we said that isn't the right methodology and it's a fair market value and you need to take into consideration reasonableness and all those other things, it's still possible that the
Certainly
trial court
possible.
Would, and more than likely probably would.
It's hard to say. I'm not going to guess what the trial court may or may not do. There's no basis for a reversal. There's no basis for a remand. The partnership agreement drafted by Mr. Costner is very specific. There can be no purchase. There can be no transfer. There can be no like-kind transactions between the general partner and himself as a general partner or any limited partner. Clearly, until there has been first a good faith effort to sell or otherwise dispose of the property for cash or readily marketable securities. And that's not my argument, that's the partnership agreement. Section 10.3 that Mr. Reynolds is very fond of, and appropriately so, says that subject to 10.4, the assets of the partnership shall be liquidated as promptly as is consistent with obtaining a fair value therefore. Again, I'm not making that argument. That's the partnership agreement. Judge Johnson ordered a sale, ordered a liquidation of the property, not because he created this out of thin air, but because he was following the terms of the partnership agreement. Mr. Reynolds, Mr. Costner, in filing the petition in this case, from the very inception of the case back in September of 2004, asked for judicial assistance in liquidating and winding up the partnership. In the response that was filed on behalf of my clients, we concurred. The partnership has been dissolved under the terms of the partnership agreement and the petition. The assistance of the court is requested to wind up and liquidate the affairs of the partnership. Section 10.3 requires liquidation, or at least a good faith effort to liquidate, before there can be any transfer in kind to any general or limited partner. The Uniform Limited Partnership Act certainly gives the court the authority and the discretion to wind up and liquidate the affairs of a partnership such as this. So you have four separate bases for upholding what Judge Johnson did. And the real question then for this court is, did he abuse his discretion in ordering the sale of the property? Clearly he did not. Petitioners asked for it. My clients agreed to it. The partnership agreement compels it. Now, you may argue that there should be some other variation or variable that would allow some neat, clean, tidy sum to be determined and transfers made among the partners in some sort of a buy-sell agreement. You can't read the partnership agreement and find a buy-sell agreement. You can't read this partnership agreement and find any obligation of my clients to sell under any circumstances other than until a good faith effort is first made to sell on the open market.
I don't understand, though. Why would the court even have a hearing about fair market value if 10.4 applies? Because 10.4 simply says if there's going to be a distribution in kind, there has to be a sale to third parties. Why would the court even bother to hear about fair market value?
In all fairness, I ask the same question. The only time there is any reference to a determination of fair market value in this partnership agreement under 10.3 and 10.4 is if there has been first a good faith effort made to sell at fair value on the open market to a third party, and it actually goes on to say none of those parties that are prospective purchasers can be a general partner or have any relationship with a general partner. This was a transaction in a partnership agreement that was designed to prohibit self-dealing. That's where the term, when Mr. Reynolds talks about fair market value, that is not even the term that this partnership agreement refers to.
But you offered testimony to the court on fair market value. Why would you even offer any testimony? Why wouldn't you simply say, Judge, we think 10.4 applies and it just requires a sale. Let's get on with the sale.
You know, I made my motion in advance of the hearing to preclude the testimony of market value. That was overruled. I guess I was trying to protect my record, but I don't disagree. Under 10.4, there can be no fair market value determination. Any valuation, in my opinion, that the court did was at best premature.
Well, but 10.3 specifically requires a valuation if the general partner is going to have any assets transferred to him.
With all due respect, what it says is subject to 10.4, the assets may be valued in that fashion. That you cannot read the provision under 10.3.1 to permit a fair market value determination unless you totally exclude the language there that says subject to 10.4. So yes, there is a provision in this partnership agreement that says if you have made a good faith effort to sell to a third party on the open market for readily available cash or marketable securities, and in the event that that were to be unsuccessful, there is a mechanism to then determine fair market value for the purposes of transferring assets in kind to the general partner. Also take a look at section 10.7.
Counsel, I guess I don't understand, because it says here transferring. It says, provided no assets other than cash shall be sold or otherwise transferred for value to the general partner, unless such assets are valued at their fair market value.
Correct. That's the sentence that's preceded by the phrase subject to 10.4. So you can't get to the valuation, fair market value, and transfer among partners without getting past subject to 10.4. 10.4 says you can't get there until you've made a good faith effort. Now, is this the best, the most efficient way of dissolving, winding up a partnership agreement? I don't know. But this court has been consistent in the past in saying the parties are free to make their arrangements. They are free to write their own partnership agreement, and it is not the function of this court to rewrite the agreement for the parties. And if you adopt Mr. Costner's theory, that is in effect what you are doing. You are rewriting the partnership agreement to grant to him a special right that is not shared by any other partner. Now, I agree, he's the big partner, we're the little partner. But an appropriate question was asked. Why is it that only Mr. Costner is free to buy the assets at 3.1? My clients would be willing to pay 3.1. They'd be willing to pay substantially in excess of that.
Well, doesn't the contract answer that? It says the general partner has the right to do this. Isn't that what the parties agreed to?
Yes, because what 10.7 says, and that's where you also have to read this in connection with this in-kind aspect of what the general partner is attempting to do, Mr. Costner is both a general partner and a 70-some percent limited partner. 10.7 says no limited partner shall have any right to demand or receive property other than cash, whether as a distribution, a payment, on liquidation, or otherwise. So actually, the 10.7 ties right back into 10.4 and prohibits transfers in kind of partnership property to a limited partner. Mr. Costner, like Knievels, are limited partners. Question is, trial court abused its discretion. Was there an abuse of discretion in ordering the property for sale? No. It's consistent with the petition. It's consistent with the answer. It's consistent with the partnership agreement. And there is no basis for a determination of fair market value on April 29th of this year or on any remand, because that can only come about under this agreement when the property has been first offered for sale in a good faith effort to try to sell it. This is Mr. Costner's agreement. I didn't write it. But I do want to talk about the value issue. I concur. I think under this agreement, the court was premature in dealing with the issue of fair market value. And I also agree with Mr. Reynolds that the court probably went beyond its authority in allowing Mr. Costner an opportunity to match the Keller offer at 6.2. I don't think there's any provision for that in the partnership agreement, nor in the statute. We do not raise that as an objection. We have not questioned that if Mr. Costner is willing to pay the fair value that a third party is willing to pay, let him have it. What we do have a problem with is the whole sense that it has to be valued at 3.1, which just coincidentally is enough to make sure that he gets 100% of the money. It can't be valued at 6.2 because we think the buyer didn't kick all the tires and was somehow irrational in making that offer. Trial court comment at the close of the evidence, you want to talk about the hypothetical willing seller, hypothetical willing buyer. He had a willing buyer, but he had an unwilling seller. And the unwilling seller is claiming that the price offered is too high. How do you put that in your formula, Revenue Ruling 59-60? The trial court couldn't do it. I can't do it. I don't think you can. The question is, what is the most probable selling price? That is the objective of fair market value. This is not a hypothetical situation. When an appraisal is made, one that had it been done properly, considers hard facts, actual transactions. We do a cost basis, and you've heard all these arguments before. We look at how much did Mr. Costner actually put into the property, and that's someplace around $6.4 million. That's not a hypothetical number. We look at the income approach to see how much money is this business generating to apply some sort of a multiplier. That is not a hypothetical. It's based upon hard facts and the actual performance of the business. We then take a look at market approach, and we look at what buyers and sellers are actually doing. Those are hard facts. So when you talk about an appraisal being pure theory, that's far from the truth. The whole sense of the appraisal is to look at what real people are actually doing in real life to determine what will this property most probably sell for. The trial court found on April 29th of this year that the most probable selling price was $6.2 million. And I say that the trial court was clearly within the facts before him to make that decision based upon the evidence. Trial court struggled as I do. When you apply a $6.2 million value, understand, as Mr. Reynolds points out, the first $3.2 million, I think, Mr. Costner gets 100% of that. He said 4.9, but it's actually 3.2. So we've got about a $3 million difference between Mr. Keller's offer and what Mr. Costner's capital account would be. Mr. Costner gets 93.5% of that amount. And so we've got Mr. Costner saying, that's too much, it's too high. There is a sense of self-dealing here that far surpasses his obligations to the partnership. And I think that's where we get off track. The issue is, what is the most probable selling price to the partnership? On April 29th, after this valuation hearing, ready, willing, and able purchasers, that amount was $6.2 million and was certainly within the court's discretion. It certainly wasn't clearly erroneous to find that the most probable selling price on that day was that amount. I think petitioner's expert testified on three different occasions in his transcript that what fair market value really means is the most probable selling price. Mr. Reynolds is correct. It's not the highest, not the lowest. It's the most probable price that would be that a transaction would occur on the open market. On April 29th, that was $6.2 million.
What precedent would this set for any other cases where fair market value needs to be determined?
Good question. To be intellectually honest, I am hoping that we do not analyze this case in terms of Revenue Ruling 59-60. The partnership agreement uses fair market value determinations only in connection with transfers in kind among the partners by the general partner. Other phrases, other places in Section 10.3 and 10.4 only refer to fair value. The property is to be liquidated as consistently with obtaining fair value, not fair market value. So Mr. Reynolds always skips the point. The issue is fair value under 10.3. Same phrase is used in 10.4, providing that a good faith effort is first made to sell or otherwise dispose of property for cash or readily available marketable securities at its estimated fair value to one or more third parties, none of whom is an affiliate of the partner. So what the partnership agreement actually refers to is not fair market value, but fair value in connection with liquidation. Fair market value, and that is used in the next sentence in each of those sections, only applies once notice has been given that the general partner proposes to transfer assets in kind to the general partner or one of the other partners. Then you do have to make a determination of fair market value under this agreement. So my suggestion is that the court's determination of fair market value is at best and at worst harmless error. No assets were bought, no assets were sold based upon that valuation. The court tried to fashion some sort of an equitable remedy that gave Mr. Costner an opportunity to hang on to his property at a price that would still net my clients some small amount of money out of their 14 years of service to this partnership. The court probably went too far. I would suggest it's harmless, and we haven't raised that in any event. Which you'll also find is numerous references in the transcript to even the testimony of Mr. Thorsenson, who identified Mr. Keller as probably being the most knowledgeable party, as knowledgeable as anyone on the market value of properties in Deadwood, given the number of properties that he's bought and sold. So I don't want to hang my hat on that, but Mr. Keller certainly, by his experience, by his knowledge, by his business interest, is certainly a very knowledgeable person on market value. Bottom line is the trial court reached the right result. The right result was an unsupportable appraisal from an expert who did not use the same hypothetical willing seller, willing buyer, as Mr. Reynolds now argues. And I think that is perhaps something to at least note, as long as my light is still green.
Still green.
Pardon?
It's still green.
It is still green. And I'm not going to push my luck here. what you have is, with all of this discussion.
No, it's yellow.
I don't disagree with Revenue Ruling 59-60, particularly in the context of estate and gift, which is where it was fashioned and where it's primarily relied upon, even by the IRS. But what we also have is Mr. Thorstenson, who came into court with an appraisal that said the fair market value of this business is zero. I mean, that's throughout his testimony, throughout his report. Fair market value based upon an income approach is zero. Fair market value based upon a market approach is zero. The only time he found that there were any value to this business is looking at an asset approach. In that asset approach, he did not consider the hypothetical willing seller, the hypothetical willing buyer. He went to the courthouse, pulled out the tax assessment, applied some sort of a formula against that, and made no effort to consider what willing sellers and willing buyers would be willing to pay for this property, refrained from obtaining any sort of real estate appraisal expertise, which he acknowledges he doesn't have, and expresses an opinion on value of an asset that he is not qualified to appraise.
Well, certainly you could have done that, though. You could have brought in a real estate appraisal expert. And
I have to tell you, a good real estate appraiser to do a complex property like this is a $20,000 to $40,000 ticket. And what we looked for is common sense. I think even Mr. Reynolds agreed that perhaps there was still some basis for that in the fair market value determination. My clients couldn't afford to do that. We don't know what the value of the interest is. We know that it's worth substantially more than what Mr. Costner is willing to pay, maybe worth more than what Mr. Keller is willing to pay. The partnership and agreement and my clients are entitled to have the property offered for sale. Judge Johnson gave Mr. Costner 2 years to put together a plan, to put together a scheme, a mechanism, a proposal, anything that would have resulted in a sale or a fair market value determination, and this is what we've got.
Your time has expired, counsel.
Can I ask one question? Sure. Is it important for us to know what is being sold here or what is being acquired? For example, does it include the building and the business as a going concern, but excludes all of the Kevin Costner memorabilia from the films and the movies and so forth?
Nobody is asking for any of Mr. Costner's personal effects or his name to be associated with the business to be sold. It's purely the hard assets of the partnership that Mr. Thorstenson said is worth more dead than alive anyway. So no, we're not looking to step in and take something that doesn't belong to us.
No, and it's not necessary to know that in order to resolve this question.
I don't believe it is.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Plummer. Mr. Reynolds, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you. It's hard to know where to begin. With all due respect, Mr. Plummer is very careless and cavalier with the facts and circumstances of the limited partnership agreement, what occurred. Let me start by a very blatant example. He said that I indicated that Mr. Costner's and his related entities' capital contributions were 4.9 and that there were really 3.2, just over what the value is, coincidentally. Well, if you look at paragraph 5 of the limited partnership agreement on page 8, and you add up the general partner's 1.179030 capital contribution and Mr. Costner's 3.736295, the number is $4,915,325. That is the capital contribution contributed by Mr. Costner and his wholly owned company, as I represented to this court, not $3.2 million. Similarly, Mr. Plummer reads into section 10.4 of this agreement language as it does not exist. It does not say in 10.4, you must sell to a third party. It says, after all debts of the partnership have been paid, the general partner or liquidating trustee may distribute in kind any partnership property, not the partnership, not all partnership assets, but the partnership property. It uses may, which is an alternative language, and it uses partnership property, and it uses distribution in kind. Nowhere in the language of 10.4 will you see what Mr. Plummer said exists, which is, if you can't sell it on the open market, though, then you revert back to 10.3. 10.3 and 10.4 have to be read together. And 10.3.1, unlike what Mr. Plummer just told you, It's not a fair value assessment. It uses the language fair market value. And since I was, it was indicated that I won't read from this agreement, let me read from it. It says in 10.3.1, as promptly as is consistent with obtaining a fair value, therefore, provided that no assets other than cash shall be sold or otherwise transferred for value to the general partner, which is Mr. Costner's company, liquidating trustee, not relevant here, any other partner, or any affiliate or related person of any of the foregoing, unless such assets are valued at their then fair market value in such sale or other transfer. So what that indicates is exactly what I told this court in my briefs and what I told this court 20 minutes ago. 10.4 and 10.3.1 can only be read together when 10.4 is an optional provision which can be exercised by the general partner, hence the term may. It pertains to distribution in kind of partnership property, not a sale of the partnership assets. Mr. Plummer's effort to try to convince this court and to try to convince Judge Johnson that there is a fourth sale component of this business completely reads Section 10.3 out of this agreement. And it doesn't make any sense that any party, I didn't draft this agreement either, frankly, nor do I know if Mr. Costner did, because neither one of us were there at the time, and there's been no evidence to that effect other than Mr. Plummer's testimony on it. But what I do know is what the language of the agreement says. And you can't read 10.4 and 10.3 together the way Mr. Plummer would have you read. There is no forced sale component. There is no draconian concept in this limited partnership agreement that says, if you guys ever want to break up, you got to sell it. Nobody can have this business. Why would 10.3.1 exist if that were the case? You might as well just scratch it right out of the agreement, because it wouldn't exist otherwise.
Why does the... How do you explain that in some cases it refers to fair value, and then the portion that you read talks about fair market value?
If you were to liquidate the property, a fair value analysis may be sufficient. If you're looking at having a general partner or affiliated partner or interested party take over the assets, as is set forth in 10.3.1, you have to first undertake a fair market value assessment. And that makes sense. We are trying to prevent, admittedly, an insider from doing something inappropriate here. We don't want, because the general partner and Mr. Costner have 93.5% interest here, and what he was writing into this agreement was, look, I don't want to come in here and steamroller over you. I want to give you a fair market value if this isn't going to work any longer. And so he put this provision in this, presumably, according to Mr. Plummer, in order to say, I'm not just going to come up with a number. I'm going to make sure it's a fair market value assessment, because I want to be fair to you. And we, and what's ironic about this is, we could have simply had a meeting and made a determination that we deem the fair market value of this business to be X, given a check to the Knievas or no check to the Knievas based on that, and moved on, and the Knievas would have been in a position where they would have had to litigate against us. Instead, in order to try to do this fairly and equitably and in accordance with what we thought would be a good way to do this for the purposes of the business, we made a decision to go to the court first and say, in order to keep this business viable and running during the course of us separating and to make sure that there's no accusations here, court, we're asking for your assistance. Help us with the orderly determination of fair market value. We want your guidance and assistance so that there's no accusations made here. That's why we went to the court in the first place. We could have simply just said, here's the determination, we're 93.5%. Good luck. If you have an issue, go to court. But we didn't. We sought solicitation of the court and help of the court for a fair market value determination.
How do you explain the significance of the subject to 10.4 phrase?
If you opted for 10.4, I'm paraphrasing what I think this says. If you took a 10.4 option, you'd have to interpret that with regard to 10.3.1. But it's only if you exercise 10.4. What this is saying is, if you exercise 10.4, flip to the next page. If you don't exercise section 10.4, keep reading. These are alternative provisions because they can't be read together in any other fashion. That's the way I interpret subject to 10.4. I also interpret it as section 10.4 only relates to a liquidation. And, it doesn't relate to the next provision, which talks about a fair market value assessment. You can't have a fair market value assessment in 10.3 and then implement 10.4. Those two don't jive together. Mr. Plummer's statements about fair market value, I think what I'm hearing him say is that the court did commit error, and he acquiesces to that. What he did say, though, that got us off the track again was, you got a real seller here, a real buyer here, excuse me. You've got Mr. Keller, who's a real buyer. What's a better value than that? It sounds good, and it's appealing to hear that, but it's contrary to the law, because the law says you don't look at real transactions. Because we don't know why Mr. Keller decided to inject himself into this. We don't know if it's because he's a friend of Mr. Plummer, since they're a client and attorney. We don't know if he hates Mr. Costner. We don't know if, because he has more money than he knows what to do with, he wants to have Jake's restaurant, fine dining, as something that's under his stable of things that he's bought after he sold out his duty-free shops. We don't know. But that's precisely the point. Mr. Keller is the poster child for why you don't look at a real seller, because we don't know what his motivation is, and it made no logical sense for him not to look at anything. It was twice the amount of money he paid for any other comparable property. If you look at his properties on a per-device basis that he bought, I mean gaming device, he paid $55,000 to $56,000 per gaming device. Under his cavalier $6.2 million, which all he did is double Mr. Thorsonson's numbers, that's over $100,000 per gaming device. That's not rational, that's not logical, and that's precisely why you have a fair market value assessment that requires a hypothetical willing buyer and a hypothetical willing seller. And conversely, he pointed out the fact that Mr. Costner is not a willing seller. Thank you. That is absolutely true. Mr. Costner is not a willing seller. He has absolutely no desire to sell this business that he built up, that he's put blood, sweat, and tears into, that he didn't get paid for, as the Knievas did, for salaries and the like. But he is interested in the infrastructure of Deadwood. He can make a lot more money other places. We all know that. But this is his business. He put his money into it, and he wants to keep it. If someone comes to you and offers you $500,000 for your $100,000 house, but it's a family homestead, and you want to keep it, it may be irrational, but you have the right to do that. And that's why fair market value assessment is not what a real buyer or a real seller would do, because they don't act rationally. They act emotionally. It has to do with what IRS Revenue Ruling 5960 is. And by going down that path, Judge Johnson committed error. This has to be reversed, I respectfully submit, in order for him to correctly apply a fair market value analysis. And then he can make a determination of what 10.3.1 says and what 10.4 says, which he hasn't done yet, incidentally. So our efforts to go down that primrose path to have this court interpret 10.4 or 10.3, that hasn't even been done at the trial court level. It's a fair market value issue and needs to be determined in that fashion, and that was error.
So if the court, so you're saying we shouldn't look at those two provisions at all? We should simply say that, according to you, the court erred on its method of evaluation, and then let the court decide whether there should be a forced sale?
I think there's still an open issue before the court, but I think the question will be, did the court interpret 10.4 and 10.3 when it forced the sale? I think clearly what this court has to say is, in addition to the error in fair market value and sending it back for that, it has to say it cannot force a sale in the method it did. Now,
so,
whether the court goes the next step.
So then we do have to interpret those two provisions, don't we?
Not necessarily, I would submit. I would submit you have to at least say the forced sale he ordered is inconsistent with 10.3 and 10.4. It just isn't there. I mean, none of the things he said that he was going to do, a 10-day provision, a 6.2 sale that's not based on fair market value, none of that is anywhere in this agreement. It's up to this court to determine whether it wants to go the next step and say, is this a 10.4 issue or a 10.3 issue?
Your time has expired, counsel. Thank you.
Thank you.
The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.